Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Vanished ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
He adored his children and he adored his family. He was so close to his parents that it just doesn't make sense that he would disappear and let both of his parents die, not knowing if he was okay. And I feel very strongly that there's somebody out there that knows something. And I just hope with all my heart that something will sway them to come forward and talk about it, no matter how horrible, no matter how disturbing. Just knowing is so much more powerful and so much more healing than not knowing. Finding a body to confirm that he is dead, to be able to give him a burial, to give him a funeral, to give him a memorial service and have that place to go back and visit and remember him so that he's remembered and he was important. I don't even think I would be angry at this point, no matter what the truth is, if he was hurt or if they were involved or if they knew that someone else was involved. I wouldn't be angry. I think the relief would be overwhelming.
On July 30th, 1997, 35-year-old Doug Jones was finishing up some jobs before taking a family trip that he was very much looking forward to. You see, Doug was a plumber who mostly worked on his own as an independent contractor. Doug and his wife, Joellen, had plans to go to Disney World the next day. They were taking their older child to Disney for the first time and leaving their infant back home in South Carolina with Doug's parents. Doug was spotted going about his day at various jobs and stores purchasing plumbing supplies. Nothing seemed amiss. But Doug never made it home from work that night and has never been seen or heard from again. Doug's truck was later found abandoned, not far from his home in Simpsonville, South Carolina. 24 years later, Doug's children have grown up and are now leading the search efforts to find their father. I'm Marissa, and from Wondery, this is episode 299 of The Vanished, Doug Jones's story. Audible offers thousands of popular favorites, exclusive new series, guided wellness programs, comedy, and exciting new voices in audio. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. The Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, doing chores, you decide. I like to listen a little bit each evening while I'm cooking dinner, and it's great for my evening walks too. Recently, I've been listening to Lay Them to Rest by Laura Norton. It's a fantastic audiobook. You don't want to miss it. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. That's audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. Doug Jones was born and raised in the Greenville, South Carolina area. He had a close-knit family and enjoyed sports, especially football. One person that we spoke to for this story is Doug's older brother, Hal. Hal was able to tell us a bit about their childhood.
I'm the oldest brother. Doug was the middle, and then we have a younger brother. Doug and I were very close growing up, just the mere fact of the closeness in our age. We played on a lot of the same sports teams together. Through that, we became very close. Doug was a very outgoing person. Everybody liked him. He's just a very likable guy. He was extremely athletic. He had outstanding athletic abilities. He was just an awesome brother. Our family is from that area. We've been in that area, in the Greenville area for many, many generations. Everyone lived within about 2 or 3 miles of my grandparents. The whole Jones life was centered around my grandparents. Of course, all the holidays were there. Every Sunday dinner was there. And many other times during the week, we would all just sort of go to my grandparents. You know, we had a great childhood. I always call it the Beaver Cleaver childhood, you know, and a lot of people don't understand that reference that aren't in that generation. But, yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, awesome parents. We never heard them argue. We never heard them fight. They didn't drink. They didn't cuss. You know, we're very religious and very loving family.
It was in Doug's late teens and early 20s that he began to experience some behavioral changes, and he turned to substances to self-medicate.
He would smoke, you know, marijuana, and you know, we did a little bit of speed and things of that nature. There were some instances that, you know, he had some issues with the police. I do know that he did get a DUI. He was in an accident. He got a DUI. He had a couple of car accidents, other car accidents.
It was clear to Doug's loved ones that he was struggling with his mental health and that self-medicating with drugs and alcohol wasn't healthy. Doug was diagnosed with bipolar disorder, and after he was put on a medication regimen that worked for him, Doug was able to turn things around and get off that destructive path that he had been on.
But once he got diagnosed and got on his medication, he was Doug again and could maintain a normal life. Then he became a master plumber. But he was a plumber for roughly about 10 years before he disappeared.
At the time of Doug's disappearance, he was married to his wife, Joellen. Hal told us how Doug and Joellen met.
He met his wife. Actually, they went to Malden High School at the same time. She wasn't in school in high school when I graduated. And 2 years after I graduated, I joined the Air Force and was gone. So I didn't know her through younger years. I only met her once her and Doug, you know, sort of reconnected or met. She worked at Burger King. Doug was working. He went in to get something to eat. They started talking. Then they ended up dating when they were both, you know, after high school and a little bit older. And they got married. I don't remember the exact date, but early 90s, 90, 92.
Over the course of their marriage, Doug continued to grow his plumbing business. Hal explained that in the lead up to Doug's disappearance, things seemed normal in Doug's life. By this time, Doug was a father of two young children and spent his days working as a plumber and his time off with the kids. Doug disappearing was not something that anyone saw coming.
As far as any events leading up to it, I mean, there's nothing that really stands out. There wasn't a significant event that would say, oh yeah, we saw this coming, or oh yeah, I understand why this happened.
July 30th, 1997 seemed like a regular day for Doug. He planned to go work at a few places, including a salon and a nursery. He was trying to finish up some jobs because Doug and Joellen had planned to leave for a family trip to Disney World the following day. They were going to take their older child to Disney for the first time and leave the baby with Doug's parents. Doug was an independent contractor who usually worked alone. It was normal for him to stop at various jobs throughout the day, popping in and out to deposit checks at the bank and pick up supplies that he needed. Hal told us what he knows happened on July 30th, 1997.
Well, he cashed a $1,500 check. At the end of the day, he went to the local plumbing parts store. He used to work for that plumbing company, so you know, the owner, one of the lady owners, knew him very well, so they talked for a few minutes, and he told her about going to Disney World the next day with the family, and that he's excited about it. And, you know, he bought a very inexpensive part for a job that he was going to do later on that evening. It was like a simple repair job that, you know, he wanted to get done before he left. She, as far as we know, she's the last person to have seen him alive, and that was roughly 4:55 to 5 o'clock. He was never seen from or heard from again of anyone that we know. He never made it to that job that evening.
We received an extensive file from the Greenville County Sheriff's Office that gives us a glimpse into Doug's day, based on the interviews they conducted with the people who saw Doug on the day that he disappeared. They spoke to the owner of the salon that Doug worked at on the day he went missing. She stated that he was at her salon that morning until around noon, when Doug left after the supplies he needed hadn't arrived. She gave Doug a check for $200 that he did cash that day. Next, they went to the nursery where Doug had also worked. They told investigators that Doug seemed totally fine when they interacted with him. Nothing appeared to be wrong or abnormal. The owner of the nursery gave Doug two checks that day, one for $900 and one for $400. Just as the salon owner had reported, the nursery owner checked their banking records, which indicated that Doug had also cashed those checks the same day. All three of those checks he received and cashed totaled $1,500 in cash that Doug would have had on him, as Hal mentioned. The final sighting of Doug was at a plumbing store around 5 p.m. The store clerk said that he bought a small amount of supplies and engaged in normal conversation. We don't know exactly what happened after Doug left the plumbing store, but he never returned home that evening, and Joellen called Doug's parents to tell them in the middle of the night.
His wife called my parents at like 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning and said that he hadn't come home, and she's the one that reported him missing from my knowledge.
The following morning, Doug's wife, Joellen, contacted the police to report Doug missing. She said that Doug had left their home on the morning of the 30th and never returned. She mentioned to the officer that Doug sometimes experienced bouts of depression. At this time, both Doug and his black 1994 Chevrolet pickup truck were both missing. But in the days that followed Doug's disappearance, his truck was located. Hal told us more about how it was found and the clues that were recovered inside.
It was not found for 2 days. It was actually spotted the next day on the 31st. A gentleman that lived on the road was jogging and he saw the truck. And it was down in the creek, and I guess he didn't think anything about it. The next day when he went jogging, it was still there. So when he got home, he talked to his wife, and I guess his wife called the highway patrol, which is what it was in those days now, state troopers. So they came out and determined that there wasn't any foul play that they could tell, and they had it towed, and my parents went and got it out of the impound lot and took it to their basement. Just sort of went through it to see what they could find, see if there was anything that they could make any connection as to what had happened with Doug. They never found the keys. They never found his wallet. They never found his pager, but all of his tools were still in his truck. From my understanding, the door was unlocked when they found it, and there was $300 in the glove box. Doug always kept an emergency stash, and he kept it in his glove box. So that was his emergency stash.
On August 6, 1997, an investigator went to interview Joellen again. She told them again that Doug had bouts of depression, but he was currently taking medication for that. She said that they did have some financial issues that concerned Doug. They weren't currently experiencing any marital problems, but several years prior, there was a brief separation that lasted a weekend when Doug left and later returned after a few days. Joellen reported that the last time she heard from Doug was when he called home and left a message on their answering machine. But it was just a normal message that didn't indicate that any problems had come up. As previously mentioned, Doug was due to go to Disney World the day after he disappeared. Joellen told the investigator that despite the fact that her husband was missing, she had decided to go ahead and go to Disney with her older child because she didn't want to alert the child that anything was wrong. The highway patrol found Doug's truck about a mile from his home on August 1st, 1997. 2 days after Doug had disappeared. This was not the agency that Doug had been reported missing to, so they didn't immediately make the connection to the missing person report. An officer with the highway patrol reported to the Greenville County Sheriff's Office that the truck was on the side of the road near a small creek. They didn't find any keys for the truck, and there were no signs that anyone had been injured inside the vehicle. The truck had sustained only minimal damage, and it was positioned with its front end down an embankment, located near a bridge that went over the creek. They checked to make sure it hadn't been stolen, and then towed it to an abandoned vehicle lot. The investigator went out to the area where Doug's truck was found to see if there was any evidence at the scene, but they didn't find any trace of Doug. He began going around knocking door to door. He wanted to know when people in the area had noticed the truck, and if they had seen anyone walking around that appeared injured or disoriented. Neighbors reported seeing the truck there on the 30th and the 31st, but didn't see anyone near it or wandering around. Hal mentioned that their parents were the ones that got Doug's truck out of the impound lot. The investigator went to speak with Doug's parents, Eddie and Rachel Jones. They reported that they last saw Doug at a family party on July 27th, just a few days prior to his disappearance. They reported that everything seemed fine at the party. They went on to explain that they had Doug's truck, and they found a receipt inside dated July 30th at 12:39 p.m., when Doug had purchased plumbing supplies at a local Lowe's. The investigator went to look at the truck himself and noted that there were no signs that somebody had been injured inside, and none of Doug's supplies or tools appeared to be missing or stolen. We had the opportunity to speak to Lieutenant Ryan Flood from the Greenville County Sheriff's Office, and he told us more about the discovery of Doug's truck.
The day after he was reported missing, his truck was located down an embankment on League Road near Jonesville Road in Simpsonville. So immediate searches were conducted there in the attempt to potentially locate him or any sort of articles. But whenever we found that truck, there was all of his plumbing tools were still in. It didn't appear anything was taken out of the car. Nothing was stolen. There was items of value inside with all of his tools. And as I mentioned, they were in the passenger seat, which really indicated to us that, you know, there was no one else in the car but him.
On August 7th, 1997, the sheriff's office conducted an aerial search over the area where Doug's truck was found near the creek. Hal told us what he knows of those early searches of the area.
They actually did do a search of the area with a lot of volunteers from my parents' church and people that my parents worked with and just friends that they knew and relatives. They did do a search. They actually brought the helicopter out and did an aerial search. I don't know if they brought any dogs out because I was living in Atlanta at the time and I wasn't there when they did the search. But I do know that there were four-wheelers involved and they searched the area. I'm not sure how extensive the search was. Was it a mile, half mile? I'm not quite sure. I do know that the lady, and I'm not sure if it was the same lady that her husband, you know, told her about the truck or if it was someone else, but someone that had a pond and she was so upset that Doug might be in her pond, she made her husband drain the pond to make sure his body wasn't in there.
A witness came forward who had known Doug from her job at a local Waffle House. She said that Doug would stop in from time to time for a meal. She claimed to have seen Doug the day after he disappeared. She said she saw him at a Big Lots store in town around 8 p.m. on July 31st. That would have been more than 24 hours after Doug was last seen at the plumbing shop around 5 p.m. on the 30th. She said that he seemed normal, but the only thing that she noticed that was different was that he was unshaven. This sighting of Doug has never been confirmed. In January of 1998, 5 months after Doug went missing, at the request of Doug's parents, the sheriff's office did another search of the area where Doug's truck was found, and again found nothing of value. After this time, it doesn't appear that much was done to look for Doug Jones. The next entry in Doug's file is from 2001, when an investigator contacted Doug's mom to ask if he was still missing. The next several hundred pages of Doug's file consist of NCIC reports that had come in over the years about John Doe's from all around the country. John Doe's that could have possibly been Doug, but none of them ever were. Doug's case went cold, and later his children became estranged from Doug's side of the family. But Doug's kids grew up and were interested in finding out what happened to their father so many years ago. A few years back, they began contacting the sheriff's office to get some answers, and the sheriff's office decided to take a fresh look at the case. Hal told us about how the investigation has evolved from the early years until now.
Prior to this one, that's just been reopened, it was very frustrating. It was not a proper investigation. They did not take it seriously. I mean, I hate to say this, but basically it was a joke because of the information that they received from his wife. They just sort of went off of that and off they went. There has been a new sheriff elected in Greenville, and he has put a new emphasis on cold cases. He's brought in different investigators, assigned it to different people to get more eyes on it, to get, to review it, get more opinions, and to start and doing more research and more investigation on it. And not, again, it's not just my brothers, it's several cases that the new sheriff has selected to have put focus on. very little to go on. And, you know, like they always said, that, you know, they can't do anything without evidence. And the rest is just pure speculation. So far, he's been awesome. He's basically updated me every week. He calls his children and updates them every week. I mean, I'm sure he's not telling me everything, but he's giving me just enough, you know that there is work being done. I find him so far to appear to be honest and straightforward and want to help and have the energy and the wherewithal to, and the tenacity to keep working on this as opposed to what it was before. Get some things done and get some things solved. Because basically, from my understanding, at least for a while, two sheriffs ago that was there for so long did not really place an emphasis on cold cases. And a lot of the people were retired detectives that he brought back on the payroll just to have in the cold case department. There are many times that I called. As a matter of fact, I've given several interviews to them. None of them, from what I can tell, were even recorded or that they documented. I know people that have called and given them information, and they would call me and say, "What a bunch of jerks. These guys blew me off. They patronized me. They, you know," and that was consistent for the entire time until this new sheriff came in, and things are different.
In recent years, Hal was able to connect with a client of Doug's on social media. This was a person that Doug had done work for immediately preceding his disappearance. Hal wanted to hear from them about Doug's demeanor at that time. This is what he told us.
Doug had roughed in their house before he went missing. You know, I reached out to them just to see, one, you know, what was his demeanor? What did he talk about? Was he there by himself? You know, did he show up on time? And they just raved about Doug. The guy said, you know, out of all the subs that I've hired and all the, you know, things people I've been involved with, Doug was probably the top two or three people in my entire life that impressed me. Said that he was always there on time, did exactly what he said he was going to do, said he was happy, said he was, if there's anything wrong in Doug's world, you'd have never known it. Doug finished subbing in their house right before, you know, he disappeared.
From everyone that the police and Doug's family have spoken to, they all seem to report that Doug seemed to be his normal self in the lead up to his disappearance. He also seemed to be looking forward to his upcoming trip to Disney World. But what could have happened after he left the plumbing shop on the evening of his disappearance that led to his truck being abandoned at the creek with no trace of Doug left behind? We all know there are things in life that you have to compromise on, but when it comes to your health, there's no compromise. So don't settle for that one doctor that isn't really addressing your needs. Instead, check out ZocDoc, the place where you can find and book doctors who will make you feel comfortable, and you can even search by location, availability, and insurance. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. Once you find the doc you want, you can book them immediately. You can filter specifically for ones who take your insurance, are located near you, and treat basically any condition you're searching for. The typical wait time to see a doctor booked on ZocDoc is between just 24 and 72 hours. That's it. I use this, and you should too. Go to ZocDoc.com/vanished and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc.com/vanished. ZocDoc.com/vanished. This message is sponsored by Greenlight. When you're a parent, you'll have your fair share of big talks with your kids. One of those big talks should involve money, and Greenlight can help with that. Greenlight is a debit card and money app for families. You can send your kids instant money transfers, get real-time notifications of spending, manage chores, and automate allowance. I've been using Greenlight with my older two kids for years. One thing that I love about it is that I can set up recurring or one-time chores, customized to my family's needs, and then my kids earn an allowance to reward them for a job well done. Not only does it motivate them to actually get the chores done, but it also teaches them a bit about financial literacy and independence. They're learning to earn, save, and spend wisely. So stop putting off the money talk and start putting your kids on the right path. Sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free at greenlight.com/vanished. That's greenlight.com/vanished to try Greenlight for free. One more time, that's greenlight.com/vanished. Doug's family had concerns about his relationship with his wife, Joellen. Like every marriage, their relationship was far from perfect. But Doug's family believes there is more to this part of the story.
She was extremely, extremely, extremely jealous, pretty volatile. That's her personality. She's still that way. After she had Doug declared legally dead after 7 years, basically, she cut the family, the Jones side of the family, off from the children, and we really didn't get to see him after that. And now her children are grown, and her children are grown and are estranged from her. She was verbally abusive to Doug. He and I would talk about it, you know, and we talked about his marriage. We talked about, you know, all of it. And she was very physically and verbally and emotionally abusive. But that's the way that her family was, her dad was to her.
Joellen had mentioned to the police that she and Doug had a brief separation years prior, when Doug had left for a weekend but later returned. Hal told us what he knows of that time.
Doug had just kind of snapped one day when she was physically abusive with him, and he just got in his truck and he left. He actually drove to Charlotte, and then one day he had a job, he had an apartment, and he had a roommate. On the third day, he came home because he said, I couldn't do it. I miss my daughter too much. I can't do that to her. And that was about 3 years before he disappeared. So, of course, she tells the police, oh, he disappears. He's got depression. He's got all these problems. This is normal. Well, it's not normal. It happened one time, you know, but if he did disappear, you know, this time he would have taken his truck, he'd have taken his tools, because that's how he made a living. But to follow up with that, when he came back, he and I were talking in mom and dad's front yard. And again, we were extremely close. You know, there are a lot of secrets that we had about and for each other that, you know, that's the way we were. And I told him, I said, here's what's going to happen. He said, I understand. I don't understand how you can still be with her. I couldn't. I give you credit for doing it. But, you know, that's either way. I said, if you choose to get divorced, I support you. If you choose to try to work it out, I support you. Either way, I support you. But here's what's going to happen. If you decide you can't handle it anymore and you do decide to take off again, you're going to tell me, call me and tell me where you're at. And I'm going to tell mom and dad that you're safe, but I won't tell them where you're at because you're not going to put them through what you put them through the last 3 days. And he agreed. We had that kind of relationship where that would have happened. And my mother always thought that I knew where Doug was because of that.
The fact that Doug had left in the past seems to have convinced law enforcement that just maybe he left again, and that this time he decided to make it permanent. But Doug's family doesn't buy that. Hal explained what investigators have told him about Joellen's cooperation with their investigation.
Well, allegedly, you know, from what I've been told, she has refused to come in for an interview. She has done a couple of phone interviews, but she has refused to actually come in for an interview from the beginning.
As Hal mentioned, their family became estranged from Doug's children several years after he went missing. Hal told us about a confrontation that occurred at his father's wake.
It was a public display. When my dad passed away in 07, and Doug had been gone for 10 years at that point, so we had been basically estranged for the kids roughly for about 3 years. Her and her family, which included her dad and her mother and the two kids, came to dad's wake, which that in of itself was okay, especially for the kids, even though they really hadn't seen their grandfather in 3 years. My mother had fainted, one from exhaustion, two from dehydration, and three from she just got hot. So everything that was going on in the receiving line. So they had taken her to a back room and was, you know, helping her. So my brother and I were still in the receiving line, and they came through and everything was fine. They never challenged me, but they would always challenge my younger brother for some reason. So when they got to him in the receiving line, of course, it started. So people had to escort them out because of they were yelling and screaming, you know, in the receiving line at my brother, you know, at my dad's wake. That's pretty par for their dynamics. And technically, we could have had them arrested in South Carolina, because if you disrupt a service like that, it's illegal. And we chose not to. But obviously, you know, we did send word to them, had the police go and tell them that, you know, if they showed up at the funeral the next day or anything else, then they would be arrested. And that was bad. Come on, it's the kid's grandfather.
Over the course of our research into this case, we were told by multiple sources that Joellen's brother had died by suicide a little over a year after Doug disappeared, and that he had left a note saying that he couldn't live with what he had done. We wanted to look into this because this has been published elsewhere, and some believe this to be damning evidence against Joellen and her family. However, we didn't want to publish that information without being able to validate it. We found in Doug's file that the police department was struggling to find records of Joellen's brother's death. We called the Richland County coroner ourselves to ask, and this is what he told us.
I mean, our report is looking, is from the hospital, is totally natural, related more to diabetes and high blood pressure. There's nothing in here concerning a suicide or injury or, I mean, that's it. That's all. There's nothing else. And like I said, it's just basically a notification to us since it was a natural death. We have a doctor certifying and it's an inpatient death, natural.
We don't know for certain where this story originated, but from what we can tell, there doesn't appear to be any truth behind it. Another strange factor is that Joellen has told people that her brother died of an ulcer while in the shower, which doesn't quite match up with what the coroner told us either. We did make attempts to reach Joellen ourselves to hear her side of the story, but over the past year that we've been working on piecing this story together, she has yet to respond. There's one detail that we briefly mentioned earlier that some people find suspicious about Joellen's behavior after Doug disappeared. They had that family trip to Disney World planned for the following day, and Joellen continued on that trip with her husband missing.
She went ahead and went to Disney World that day with her three-year-old, and she ended up getting a friend and her son to go with them. But yet, that's not a red flag that police would investigate her, investigate the house, or, you know, anything. They never searched or forensically analyzed her car, and they never searched or forensically analyzed their house.
Now that Doug's children are grown, they've reconnected with Doug's family and joined Hal in the search to find answers.
That's the case with these, with his children. They are estranged from their mother. They have no contact, and they just want justice for whomever is responsible.
We were also able to speak with Doug's children, who were both very young when their father disappeared. Doug's older child, Ducky, was just 3 years old when he went missing. Ducky told us about their memories from that time and growing up with a missing father.
I was only 3, and Amelia was actually only a couple months old. It was 1997. I had just turned 3 the month before. So I was really young, and I don't have a lot of memory of the disappearance itself, but I have like a lot of everything that happened afterwards. I know that my mom had a couple like news channels come and interview us when we were little kids. I have like this distinct memory of having to swing on the swing set so they could have like a rolling shot of us. But I do have a couple memories of my dad that I really cherish. I remember some of the gifts he would bring me back home after work. I remember he brought me this giant stuffed alligator that I absolutely adored, and I wish I still had it. And I remember one time where I was sitting watching a movie. And, you know, as a kid, I was like playing with his face, and I accidentally stuck my finger like too far up his nose, and it started bleeding. My favorite one is I've always loved like insects and bugs, especially when I was a little kid. And we would play this game. We would catch a June bug in our backyard, and we would tie like a thread, like a string to it. He would swing it in the air like a helicopter, and then when he stopped, it kept like dizzily flying in a circle in the air. I wish I could have had more. I was definitely a daddy's little girl. I feel pretty lucky because now I have a bunch of people in my life that I really care about. I'm very thankful, especially because my fiance's family is just wonderful. Of course, I have Amelia, who is my closest family member because we went through so much together. And I've been reconnecting with a lot of my dad's side of the family, and that's been really good for me. I love them a lot. They're all so sweet. I was really looking for, at the time, it was when I was back in college, I identify as non-binary gender-wise, and I was really looking for a new name that could still fit me, but could be kind of in the middle, could go for, like, you know, genderless. I used to have this backpack, and it was yellow, and it had this gigantic duck face on it, like this big old rubber bill. And I was visiting my fiance, and we were just going to grab some things from a grocery store. And it was just like a grocery store employee that was just there. She's the one who started calling me Ducky, and it just kind of clicked. I'm like, oh, that's perfect. I love it.
Despite being only 3 years old, Ducky has memories of that trip to Disney World and returning to find that Doug had still not come home.
Obviously, I grew up with my mom as a single parent, so I feel like most of my information I've gotten from her and just like what I experienced growing up. So I know that he was a plumber, and he went to go buy some parts around, I think it was 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and then didn't show up to his last job after that. And my mom, we had a trip to Disney World planned for the next day. She left with me, and then we also, instead of taking my dad, we took one of her childhood friends and then her son, Anthony. It was Lisa and Anthony, and we all went to Disney World. And I have a lot of good memories from Disney World, but I also remember there just being so much tension, and a lot of arguments were breaking out. And when we came back, my mom always told me, like, she was surprised that he hadn't come back, because the way she said it was she felt like she wanted to kind of teach him a lesson, because from what she told me, she thought that maybe he was just kind of like staying at a friend's house or doing something else. And she wanted to teach him, like, oh, no, you can't abandon your family, sort of thing. Growing up, it was really, really, we struggled a lot financially. We were on a lot of Social Security kind of things, and Medicaid and food stamps, and we got an amazing amount of support from the community. I mean, it was really like churches and stuff that were keeping us afloat, and also so many family members, including Hal and also my Uncle Barry. And there's a ton of people who really shipped in. We had my dad's childhood friend, whose name was Jan. She was always giving us clothes and stuff, which was just fantastic. They really helped us get through there. But then around 2004 was when it would have started, was when my mom started to declare my father dead. And that was a pretty tumultuous time. She, of course, was looking for what she called closure, and also the financial support of declaring someone dead. And that's really when she started distancing our family from the Jones family. There were a couple times where, you know, they didn't disagree about things that were going on with the case, or she wasn't giving them information about the case. And she's a very paranoid sort of person. And she told me that she was paranoid that they were going to, like, ruin the case so that she couldn't declare him dead. They really became kind of like the enemy to my mother, and then, of course, to me.
After Ducky grew up and went through some therapy, they started to realize that many things that had occurred during their childhood were abusive, and that the Jones side of the family wasn't the enemy. Ducky started to distance themselves from Joellen. Ducky explained how this has now become complete estrangement from their mother.
It really wasn't until I was in college and going to therapy that I really realized, like, oh, shoot, I have the power to really go back and reforge those relationships, and maybe everything my mom said wasn't true, kind of thing. And it's important to note that my mother was very emotionally, psychologically, verbally, and physically abusive, especially when we were younger, but then it became more emotional and verbal as we got older and bigger. She has had a lot of trauma in her life. She grew up in an abusive household, and then, of course, like with my dad, having to become a single mother and everything with my father was just even more trauma on top of that, according to her. So that made it harder growing up. When I graduated college, I actually packed up my car with everything that I could carry in it, and my fiance was there to support me. My mom knew that I was going to Vermont, and I'm still here, and I'm doing great, very happy here. But I didn't tell her exactly where. You know, she came up to hug me at the very end, and I just kind of stepped back. I wanted to say something very neutral and mature because I was aware that no matter what I said to her, she was going to twist it. I just said, hey, thank you so much for raising me and everything you've done for me and everything you've sacrificed for me. But unfortunately, because of the way that you've treated me and you continuously treat me, this is goodbye. Please don't contact me after this kind of thing. Then I drove away and drove all the way to Vermont, and I haven't talked to her since. Sometimes I still get voicemails from her pleading, and she also kind of uses my grandmother as a way to try to get me to call her. So she's also blocked off that relationship for me as well. A lot of the stuff that she put in my head, right? Like it's right now, I feel like I've gotten over the majority of my recovery. At this point, I'm kind of just having to reroute my brain so that I can really like myself and try to undo the expectations that were put on me and that I'm still trying to live up to. And also a lot to do with like self-confidence and self-love in a way. But that's what I'm going through now.
It's clear from the things that Doug had told his family about his relationship with his wife and what their children have reported that there's a long history of allegations that Joellen was abusive to people close to her in her life. We don't know what happened to Doug, and that doesn't necessarily make Joellen a murderer. However, Doug's family feels like his case was never properly investigated, and at the very least, their relationship needs to be examined closely by authorities.
All possibilities need to be looked at, and that includes her having any sort of role, from it being as little as just being a component of stress in his life to maybe something happened where he ended up hurt or anything like that. Because my mother was the kind of person who would physically lash out. And I can imagine, I'm not necessarily pointing fingers because I don't know everything, right? But I can see something happening to where she may have used too much force and maybe he ended up dead. I can imagine something like that happening just because of the intimacy that I knew with her growing up. And I knew that she could flip like a switch. And it was often about small things. But I mean, we were just about to go on a big trip and a couple things just don't sit right with me, right? I don't really understand why we went on a trip to Disney World when my dad was a missing person. I don't understand that. I don't understand why his car was found like a mile and a half from our house or a mile walk from our house. I don't understand why growing up, I feel like my mom really described him as a villain to me. My mother had a lot of negative things to say about my father to me, and she kind of got rid of everything of his, like all of his stuff. We didn't have much of my father's possessions to hold on to after he was gone. I think I ended up having like a shirt or two and a little sculpture. And I think she had some like poetry that he had written her back when they were dating. But other than that, there wasn't much, at least that I know of. It just is a lot that just doesn't add up. And I'm aware that also it's a strong possibility that my father was mentally ill. And sometimes people who are mentally ill don't act rationally. That could be a factor as well. But my mother was mentally ill as well. She was suffering from a lot of trauma. And I think that she would lash out outwardly because she didn't know what else to do. And that's how she was taught to act. She would say stuff like, oh, no, your father's not coming back. And pretty much my entire life, I understood that he was deceased because that's what she believed. Because we would talk about it sometimes, and it would be something like, oh, well, you know, he could have run away, but it's more painful. So it's less painful for me to believe that he's deceased. I understand she was very paranoid that maybe he was cheating on her and she would follow him around and stuff and check his belongings and try to catch him in it. And that was something she still tried to do. I mean, obviously not with cheating, but with like grades and stuff and trying to catch us in lies a lot of the time as we were growing up. And we were very polite, very well-behaved children. So it wasn't really needed.
Ducky has seen a portion of Doug's missing persons file. In reading over the statements that Joellen gave to the police, Ducky finds the way that Joellen spoke about her marriage to Doug to be misleading.
There was a lot of marital discord between my mother and my father. And I know that when you get the case report, I've read through it as well and looked at what they could give us. And she claimed that their marriage was all good. Like there was a statement in there saying like, that they didn't have any marital trouble, but it was far from that because, I mean, even growing up, she would always share, I would say, too much with me about all the arguments and stuff that she would have with my dad. And she never brought up the word divorce. But now that I'm older, I know that that was something that was discussed because my father went to my grandfather trying to confide in him and try to talk about it. But my grandfather was a very conservative Christian kind of Southern Baptist kind of man. And he really believed that, you know, once you start something, you know, you gotta make it work. And that's what he advised. And from what I understand, he, for the rest of his life, regretted giving my father that sort of advice. But we actually recently found physical evidence that their marriage was actually pretty tumultuous. I went over to my uncle to see my uncle for the first time in 15 years, Uncle Hal, recently. And we were just looking through albums and stuff. And we actually found an album that my Nima, my father's mother, put together. It looks like something he wrote as if he needed to use it if they were to get divorced. It's like a letter that just explains this disagreement that they had and how they were, you know, there was a lot of yelling and how he said we should just get a divorce, and that just made her super angry, even though she was yelling at him to leave the house and stay at my grandmother's and all of that. But I know that there were several times where they were kind of low on money, and I know that that had to be a stressor.
Ducky has conflicting feelings about Joellen and the possibility that she could be involved in Doug's disappearance. If law enforcement had investigated Joellen thoroughly along the way, it would have eased those feelings.
I don't think my mother has ever been like officially interrogated in any sort of sense. I would imagine she would become very defensive because that's just how she is as a person. And from what I understand, she was very cooperative at first with this renewed interest in my father's case, but is now not as cooperative. I mean, I feel like that could be taken several different ways, but her property has never been searched. I encouraged the investigator while we have the cadaver dogs to maybe just, if they can get even her permission, because I know it would have to be for permission. That's what's so tricky, right? Is can't get a warrant. So I encouraged them to try to search back there just in case, because if I'm thinking about it, it's very hard to move a body, and she never left that house. She's always been in that house, and I mean, it's hard not to wonder.
Ducky grew up being told that it was likely that Doug just walked away and abandoned his family. This is a very hard concept for children to process, and as we have heard in many other cases where a parent disappears when their children are very young, it can be very damaging to the children left behind, growing up thinking that they were abandoned. In hindsight, looking at the situation from the lens of an adult, that theory no longer holds weight to Ducky.
What my mother had told me is that, oh, you know, he's an adult. He ran away kind of thing. Maybe he started a new family. He didn't want these responsibilities anymore, which is very frustrating because he did have a mental illness. And I know that I have to consider that being something that would influence his decisions and everything going on. But at the same time, isn't that just so convenient to have someone who disappears with mental illness? I feel like it's very convenient to blame the disappearance on his bipolar disorder. Since he had medication, if he still stayed alive, how would he be getting his medication? He wouldn't. When he was off his medication, he would have manic episodes. So I feel like he would have been noticed. I just think it's such a stretch to think that he went to go start a new life. When they did search his car and the area around it, if someone were to crash and walk away, you think you'd find something? And also, they didn't find his wallet or his keys in his car. All his plumbing supplies were there. And also, there was $300 in the dashboard. So if someone were to suddenly decide to leave, you would assume they would take all of the money that they can.
The Vanished is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up after the winter, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. It's a good time to think about the right amount of socializing for you. Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you prefer more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. A therapist can help you learn how to set boundaries so you feel empowered to be the best version of yourself. Everyone can benefit from therapy. It's not just for those who've experienced major trauma. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, so it's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/vanished today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/vanished.
Imagine upgrading your wardrobe with luxury essentials at unbeatable prices. Quince is here to transform the way you shop with a range of high-quality items priced within reach, like 100% Mongolian cashmere sweaters for $50, organic cotton sweaters, washable silk tops, and timeless 14-karat gold jewelry. The best part, all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to us. And I was thrilled to learn that Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices and premium fabrics and finishes. I love that. I now have several items from Quince. I love their cardigans, pants, and shirts. I find their pieces to be easy to mix and match, and also to dress up or dress down. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/vanished for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/vanished to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/vanished. We also spoke to Ducky's younger sister, Amelia, who was just a baby when her dad disappeared. Amelia told us what it was like growing up from her perspective.
I think I was around 4 or 5 months old when he disappeared in 1997. Realistically, I could not have even had like my own memory with him. The memories that Ducky did have were fond. There was never really anything that was negative from Ducky, from my dad's side of the family. It was all, you know, really, really, really positive things. Every time we would go to family gatherings, people would always say, you know, that he had loved us so much and that he cared so much. At that age, when I was growing up, it was a little conflicting because my mother didn't really give me the same description. She didn't say that he was the worst person in the world or that he was abusive in any way, but she had mentioned a lot of times that he wasn't, I guess, a good functional adult. From what I can remember, she had just discussed that he would constantly leave if he wasn't on his medication. She said that he had voluntarily gotten off his medication regarding bipolar disorder, and it would send him in frenzies. She said there was a time where he got so amped up that he had threatened to kill her father. And that I think there was a whole moment where he was at her parents' house where they were trying their best to calm him down. And she said that it was just for no reason. It was because he's off his medication or something. You know, all these different things. I grew up with like this memory that he was this unstable person, which was weird because on the contrary, when I grew up, I didn't start talking to my father's side of the family more in depth until 2000 and I think 16 or 17 was when I actually started talking to like my uncle and my great aunt and that side of the family again through like text messages. I heard a lot of things from Ducky when they were discovering new things about our father. There was so many stories that we were told by our mother that from the other family's perspective and their stories was completely wrong. For example, in that case where my mother had said that he had gone on that one rampage threatening her father's life, it had been because of something that she had told my father about that he had done to her, he being my grandfather on my mother's side. And it was, you know, it was something that for, you know, for the sake and purposes of people's privacy, it wasn't good. But it was enough to enrage Doug to a point where he almost couldn't forgive this man, basically. So I don't know. It's just all these things. I was always told that he was reckless or careless. My father's side of the family, complete 180 almost, was just, he cared so much and he was focused so much on our well-being, being the kids, and wanting to make sure that he could provide. And instead of it being like the struggle of my mom trying to hold the family together, it was actually my father trying to hold the family together while my mother was causing the issues, from what, you know, I've been told.
These conflicting versions of Doug have been difficult for both Ducky and Amelia to reconcile. While Ducky has some memories of their father, Amelia has none to base her own thoughts, opinions, or theories on. There seems to be two sides of the story that are very different, and it makes finding the truth more difficult. As Amelia and Ducky grew up, they were trying to come to terms with how they felt about the loss of their father, but also their troubled relationships with their own mother. Amelia gave us her perspective on this.
Given my history with my mother, I definitely believe my father's side is, if anything, probably, if not 100%, then definitely much more truthful than my mother. It's a lot of physical and verbal abuse that I had suffered, I'd say, as early as kindergarten. So ever since I was about 4 or 5 was when I have some memories of the abuse starting. And it could be as simple as just not being as quiet as she would like to, or being too rowdy, whether it was like in a grocery store or at a friend or family member's house. She would, you know, either give me a kind of stern talking to in that moment, but going home was where a lot of the hitting and the yelling happened. She would yell my ear off about it. She would sometimes, there were moments I remember where she's directly like not even 2 inches away from my face, like screaming. Everyone's lives are different. So, you know, whatever, and everyone's brains are different too. So what people can handle and what people can't handle is different. When I was, you know, that young, it didn't make any sense to me. So I would start crying. And then sometimes she would get angry that I was crying because I'd be crying too loud to hear what she was saying to me. And I know that in the South too, people were never, they never turned an eye of surprise if somebody spanked their child. But spanking wasn't where my mother stopped. It was, you know, spanking, it was not even like a pop on. It was more of a, like she was using as much force as she could. And it was along, not just, you know, spanking, it was throwing around, picking up by like the scruff of collars of shirts. She never really used objects to hit us with besides her own fists. She had a lot of manipulation tactics as well, because even since back when I was 5 years old, that's when she started planting seeds in my brain that my father's side of the family didn't care for us or wanted to take us away from her. You know, used phrases like, they're working against us, it's us against the world, including me and my sister into conflicts that were just actually between herself and whatever other person or entity it was.
Earlier, Doug's brother Hal explained that after Joelle and had Doug declared deceased, they became estranged from Doug's children. Even though Amelia has no memories of Doug due to being an infant when he disappeared, she does have fond memories of Doug's family from the time before that estrangement occurred. Amelia explained how confusing this all was to her as a child, being ripped away from a grandmother whom she adored.
The family member I was closest with at the time when I was really young was my meemaw, who was my grandmother on my father's side. I have memories really young, hanging out with her at her house, going to restaurants and eating out, spending nights outside during the summer, catching fireflies in a jar. Wonderful memories. And each time we visit her or see her, it was a bout of excitement. I'd hug her the hardest I could as a kid, until slowly my mother would tell us stories about how our grandmother was working against us, how she was plotting to take us away, and how she was hurting us because she was trying to get information regarding my the case with my father's disappearance. I remember distinctly growing up, my mother had made a huge deal about declaring my father dead, and that waiting 7 years, I think almost exactly 7 years is when she had filed the paperwork. And she was trying her hardest to expedite that without telling my father's family and trying to get it taken care of as quickly as possible without anybody trying to stall it. At the time, she had made it sound like they were working to try to stop it and prevent it, because if they did stop it, then we would have no income from survivor's insurance or from Social Security.
It appears that Joellen's main motivation for wanting to have Doug declared dead as soon as possible was that she wanted to be able to receive the financial benefits. To be fair, Joellen was a single mother with two young children, who was struggling to keep things afloat after her husband's sudden disappearance. There may be nothing nefarious about her pushing to have this declaration made as quickly as possible to help her put food on the table, but the estrangement from Doug's family was extremely difficult on the children and also on Doug's side of the family. They had already lost Doug, and now they had lost the kids too. One thing that Ducky brought up to us was that after Joellen had Doug declared deceased, she received a monthly payment from Social Security, plus a large lump sum payment. Ducky recalls that lump sum being around $86,000. In hindsight, Ducky finds some of Joellen's spending to be excessive. She purchased a new car, went on lavish vacations, purchased expensive clothes, appliances, you name it. Soon, the money was gone. The court had ordered that some money be put aside for Ducky and Amelia. But around 3 years later, they signed to take the money out prematurely, because Joellen needed it to pay the bills. Some feel like the spending spree could point to a possible motive being money. However, 7 years is a long time to wait, and it could just point to irresponsible money management. Amelia told us what she remembers of this time.
It was a huge misuse of money on her part. That income that she didn't spend properly was the, once my father was declared dead, it was the survivor's insurance and the Social Security that she had received from the government that she didn't use correctly. I remember distinctly us going on at least two big trips to Disney World. It might have been three. I don't remember. Spent, you know, thousands of dollars on these non-necessity related things. You know, at the time, we already had a TV, we already had a couch, we already had cabinets, refrigerator, and oven and stove. If it's not knowing how to handle money, that's one thing, but you know, there could be greed connected.
There were some other strange things that Amelia and Ducky recalled from their childhoods. For instance, Joellen had shown them that she had both her wedding ring and Doug's. If Doug had never returned home from work and disappeared without a trace, how did Joellen have his wedding ring? Is it possible that Doug didn't wear his ring to work since he was a plumber and did a lot of work with his hands? Or does this indicate something that should be looked into further? Ducky also remembers that Joellen stopped sleeping in the bedroom she shared with Doug after his disappearance, and continued to do so for about 15 to 20 years. Amelia only has memories of Joellen sleeping on the couch, and the bedroom being locked and off-limits during her childhood, and she never really understood why. Was Joellen just a grieving spouse, who found it too difficult to sleep in the same bed that she shared with her missing husband? Or was there something more to this? Amelia has spent a lot of time reflecting on her own childhood, and she imagines how different her life could have been, or might have been, had Doug been there.
Not being able to rely on more than one person for support or help, especially in my case, the person that I would, you know, need to lean on for help when I was going through tough times in middle school with bullying and people treating me like garbage, I couldn't even talk to her. You know, if I had two parents, I really don't think I would have gone through as much abuse as I had gone through, just because of the fact that if one parent is the perpetrator of this abuse, the other could at least be there to try to lessen it or stop it. At one point, maybe they would have, if I did have two parents, probably been a divorce eventually.
Just as Ducky told us, Amelia felt like she had to create distance between herself and her mother. She knew it was a toxic relationship, and it was bad for her mental health for things to continue the way that they had been.
I needed some distance because I was like, whether I like her or not, I need distance from her so I can process these things. I grew up with the internet. I, you know, was able to get a lot of gathering of information about, you know, how to go about living with trauma, dark thoughts, and the moments of the bouts of suicidal ideation, basically, and how to fight back on that. I used a lot of YouTube to also kind of discover my own queer identity. I was able to sort of come into my own. It was definitely growing up a pinpoint of abuse and like manipulation that my mother could jab at every once in a while. I remember the hugest thing too, growing up before I started transition, 2014, when I came out to my mother about my transition, one of her hugest insults to me was that I'm just like my father. Actually, now that I remember, there was one time I think I had seriously tried to run away from home. I didn't get far. It was just down the street. But I came back. And when I came back, she was already telling me to just go ahead and leave like my father did. So that's definitely been a huge problem I struggled with growing up. And it was a huge cause of resentment to my father for so many years because of it. Because she used him as a comparison for negative feelings towards me. So I started to feel that it was his fault. At some point, I thought that we were alone with her and that I was going through the pain I was going through because of him, because he abandoned us. When it came to my transition, it was definitely, she didn't stop saying that. When I had told her and come out and been open, because I entered college as a woman and all my friends, you know, knew me that way. And
in college, Amelia made several attempts to sever the relationship with her mother, but there was a lot of manipulation from Joellen, which left Amelia feeling guilty. There were times that Amelia would stop talking to Joellen, and Joellen would show up at her dorm room to confront her. Amelia decided to send her mom a message, expressing her feelings and need for space. But instead of helping to calm the tensions, things continued to escalate to the point where Amelia had to completely cut her mom out of her life.
I had not sent her a text message or a call or answered one of her messages or calls starting in April of 2019 until June of that same year. And I gave her a very long message that I had worked as hard as I could to type out in the most objective way as I could, because I didn't want to cut her off completely. I knew that she had been through a lot herself. She at first took it well. She said, thank you for responding. And, you know, the whole, I love you and I hope to talk to you soon. Good luck. And then I thought at that time she was not going to respond to me for a good time. I thought she was going to start getting time to heal, start to go to therapy, start to get counseling, you know, for her own issues, maybe even some start taking medication. It seemed like that at the beginning. She mentioned she was seeing a therapist, and then she would start to try to contact me again and again and again. And then in September, she dropped some really intense messages on my phone that were extremely unsavory, for lack of a better word. She said, "I don't understand why you do this to me." She said that I had promised I would never hurt her like this, and that my father did this to her, and that I've been mean to her for years, ignoring her and not talking to her. And she had mentioned that she wanted to kill herself because of me and my sister, made her so depressed, especially since I was in middle school. And she wanted to end it then, when we were in middle school. She said she's ashamed to be our mother and that we're spoiled because her therapist said so. That moment in September, I snapped a little bit. I didn't respond to her because I knew that would be what she wanted. So instead, I made a post on Facebook to all my friends from high school, all my friends from college, you know, all friends I had made throughout the years, to see, describing what I had been through growing up and how my mother couldn't be trusted and how she was a monster and all these horrible things that she had done to me, and to not ever give any information regarding me or my whereabouts to her, for my own safety and, you know, for my own well-being. That's when I officially decided that I can't keep a relationship with her. It was a relief at the beginning, and then it started to weigh on me for about half a year. And when the pandemic hit, it shifted everything. Not only was I already going through a lot of fighting through a lot of emotional pain and trauma to better myself, it really rocked my world for a while. I was able to sort of sit back and just collect everything and kind of go through it and just process that. So now I'm feeling much more confident in my decision. I feel it was definitely a good idea, because her lashing out at me was just the same cycle that I was used to growing up. It's the same thing of she'd attack us, yell at us, tear us down with her, when we were younger, her hands and her words, and then eventually just her words. And then she would come back, you know, not a day or a couple of days later, apologizing, saying she loved us, that she would never do it again. And that kept happening. So this break that she had, where she had a moment of anger, was just that cycle repeating. And she's continued to have that apologetic cycle, where she's trying to show that she loves me and that she wants to talk to me again because she cares about me and wants me to be safe.
Amelia and Ducky continue to struggle with their relationships with their mother, which were clearly abusive and controlling. As Amelia reflects back on the abuse that she's endured, she wonders what things were like for her father, and if her mother's history of abuse could have been a factor in his disappearance.
Growing up, you know, it was a conflict of stories. I grew up with what my mother had told me up until 2016 is when I started learning about what actually was going on. I trust my father's side of the family more with the truth than my mother. So what I know of what actually has happened is they had a rocky marriage for a long time. I know, at least it's on record in the sense of some journal entries that my father had made during 1996, that there was tension in discourse of their marriage. There was a lot of financial issues. My uncle was his best friend, his closest family member. It was, you know, everything my dad knew, my uncle Hal knew. And he had told my uncle anytime that he would try to leave my mom, he would always come back because he couldn't abandon his children. He couldn't leave us with her. My uncle had said that he loved us so much. It doesn't make sense that he would suddenly vanish, especially at this moment when, in that week, I believe they were planning on going to Disney World when he suddenly vanished. And they still went to Disney World. But at the time, I felt like it could have been much easier for a mother of two in South Carolina with a father figure that was clinically diagnosed with a mental disorder to be able to claim just a sudden freak disappearance gone wrong.
Ducky has similar feelings about Joellen. They aren't sure if their mother is scarred from her own traumas and truly a victim of others, and the disappearance of her husband was just one more trauma, or if she could possibly be involved.
I just remember back to like the worst times she's ever gotten angry, and she's animalistic. It's not like a person, like it's strange. So those are the things that we've really talked about. But really with my mom, I kind of see her as a corpse of a person she could have been, because whatever she could have been has already been rotting away. She hasn't taken the time, and I don't know if she has the resources or the perspective to really truly help herself, because she was victimized so much as a child. She went through so much. She was traumatized. And then, you know, if she had nothing to do with my dad, then she was traumatized by that as well. She has never processed that. And so she still sees herself as such a huge victim that she's not able to recognize when she's hurting other people, and she's not able to apologize and really take responsibility for any of her actions. Because there are a couple times that she would take responsibility. Like one time we were coming home from, I think it was like a Christmas Eve service, a church service. And she just started bawling on the way home. She's like, I'm such a bad parent. I'm so mean to y'all. I'm so sorry. I'm going to be better. And then of course that lasted like, you know, a month, because then she eventually convinced herself, no, we're horrible children and we deserve to be talked to like that. It's just interesting, the glimpses of recognition and of the hurt that she's caused other people, but it doesn't last and she always takes it back. I think she's severely mentally ill. And I don't think it really is something that you notice the first couple times you talk to her, because she comes off as a very fun kind of person. She comes off as very spontaneous, very happy, very adventurous. And that's who I think she could have. She comes off that way, but then like once you get to know her, you kind of realize like, oh, she kind of just is like a teenager in a 50-something-year-old's body. It's like her trauma happened to her and she hasn't matured past that. I think she's stuck there. When I look at it from an outside perspective, God, yeah, she's not acting right kind of thing. I mean, I defended her up until actually my fiance, Abby. She is the first person that really like argued with me about, hey, the way your mom talks to you, the way she treats you is not normal. And I actually like got mad because I wanted to protect the person who was hurting me, because I was so dependent on her and I was so convinced that I deserved it.
Ducky has considered so many theories about what could have possibly happened to Doug more than 24 years ago. But without much evidence to go on, it's hard to know for sure.
I believe very strongly that someone hurt him. I'm not convinced 100%. I have to kind of stay in the middle because I don't have any solid proof, but I feel very strongly that he wouldn't have just walked away, especially since it was right the day before a family vacation. And also, there's just like some weird parts to it, right? Like, if he were to try to run away and start another life or something, he wouldn't have left $300 of his emergency money in the glove compartment. Whoever set his car there, okay, I'm saying whoever set his car there, because I personally believe that it was planted, but they didn't know that the $300 was in the glove compartment. So I feel very strongly that he's deceased. I feel like someone hurt him. I don't know if it was an accident or on purpose. He had some money on him, so I wonder if someone robbed him, but there's no evidence of any sort of foul play around his car or anything like that. So that doesn't make a lot of sense. And I have to also keep on the table that maybe my mom had something to do with it, just because I know her personality. I know that she can kind of lose herself to anger. And I can imagine, I just think about, you know, what if he came back home after work and, he still had another job to do. But maybe he came home for dinner and a fight
broke out and she accidentally hurt him. It wouldn't make sense. She's not the kind of person that would premeditate that. It wouldn't make any sense. But so I have to keep that as an option as well. And it's hard thinking about what if I lived with this person who did this kind of thing, right? But I have to keep that as an option. And of course, I also still hold what if he is still out there and alive and he did just run away? I mean, to me, that would be best case scenario. That would be, oh my God, my dad's alive. I would have to deal with the emotional fallout of that. But oh my God, what if I have like stepsisters and stepbrothers and family that I don't even know about? Like that would be so exciting to me. I have to also consider the fact that he was mentally ill, which is something else that makes me think that he didn't just run away or he's not alive, because how would he get his medications for bipolar disorder? There would be some sort of record of him trying to get a refill or going to the doctor or something. And when he was off his medicine, he was very manic and he would make himself known one way or another. If he did just snap and leave or something like that, he would have been found. He would have been a homeless person yelling on the street. He may have like caused some sort of destruction of property and like the police may have had records of him, but they didn't. So it just doesn't make sense that that's something that would have happened to him. And something else I have to consider too is, I don't know, what if he hurt himself? And I don't know why you would do that the day before going on a trip, but maybe there was some stressors that I don't know about. Maybe he felt trapped. I know that I've definitely felt trapped in that house.
Hal, Ducky, and Amelia all remain hopeful that with the new investigators looking at the case, that a new clue will be discovered that will give them a new direction to look in. In September of 2020, investigators returned to the area where Doug's truck was found abandoned to search one more time.
So they did a cadaver dog search of that creek area and they didn't turn up anything. You know, he told me he was knocking on people's doors and having to like ask permission if they could really have that search. I mean, they've been doing stuff now. I just think, you know, it's a damn shame that they didn't do anything in the beginning, because that's when all the evidence was there. It's a very shallow, it's right off of League Road. It's a very tiny creek. The car didn't crash in there. It seemed like it was just like gently parked because the truck wasn't hurt or anything. The only damage that the truck sustained was when they were taking it out of the creek, it actually hit some metal on the bridge part of the road. The car wasn't hurt or anything. You'd think if someone were to just accidentally crash there, it'd be like there would be some damage.
Lieutenant Flood told us more about that September search.
We recently, as recent as September, sent some of our cadaver dogs down through Foothill Search and Rescue, an attempt to locate any potential remains or articles that may have been left behind from back in 1997. Nothing turned up from that search to date, though. The goal was to locate any sort of potential remains. You know, we want to be able to rule out any and everything, whether he is deceased there or not. You know, we wanted to be able to potentially locate any sort of remains, the bones, or rule that possibility out. Not that we're ruling that out at this time, but in conclusion to that search, we didn't locate anything to indicate that, through the cadaver dogs at least, to indicate that he was there. But recently, we have also gathered DNA from a close relative and sent Doug's fingerprints through. But to date, you know, obviously we haven't got any matches, but who knows?
During this recent renewed effort to find out what happened to Doug, investigators contacted Joellen to speak with her about her husband's disappearance. During their phone call, Joellen stated that Doug took his medications for bipolar disorder, but that he hated taking them. She said that when he was on them, he was wonderful, but a completely different person without his meds. We know from speaking with Amelia and Ducky that Joellen had always told them that Doug abandoned the family. During the interview with the investigator, Joellen mentioned her reasoning behind this belief. She was aware of the Waffle House employee who claimed to have spotted Doug at Big Lots. A friend had allegedly told Joellen that she swore she saw Doug 2 years after he disappeared. This alleged sighting was at an amusement park with a woman and a little girl. Joellen also mentioned that her sister was at a drive-thru behind a white pickup truck, and someone inside looked like Doug. The person turned around, spotted Joellen's sister, and ducked. Joellen claims that her family didn't want to upset her. They wanted her to move on. So they decided not to tell her about that sighting for several years. Joellen said that she wishes she had never given up on looking for Doug. She wants to know what happened so she can find some closure. But at the same time, she doesn't want to find him. She didn't get into another romantic relationship for about 15 years after Doug went missing, and says she has since moved on with her life. Ducky and Amelia confirmed to us that this was true. Joellen didn't date for many years. Before hanging up with Joellen, the investigator asked her to email him a full statement of her story, and she said she would work on it. For reference, the investigator was conducting these new interviews via phone during the middle of the COVID-19 pandemic and asked all the family members interviewed if they could send a statement via email. Even though Joellen initially agreed, she later called back and stated that she had a stressful week at work due to COVID-19 restrictions and didn't wish to spend her time on the weekend typing out a statement for the investigator. From the records that the Greenville County Sheriff's Office sent us, that appears to be their last interaction with Joellen. We don't know if they've since spoken to her again after a records request was granted. Lieutenant Flood explained to us that the combination of Doug's mental health history and also the incident that occurred several years prior when Doug left for 3 days and went to Charlotte has shaped their perception of what they believe may have happened in this case.
You know, we received information during the course of these years since his missing that he had some mental illness, that he would become manic depressant. He was said to be pretty depressed around the time of his missing, from what we gather from his wife. And as I mentioned, he had 2 to 3 years prior to him gone missing, he had left and vanished and went to Charlotte. And around that time, he had made it known to a relative that, you know, this is during his marriage, that he had got a job, got a place to stay, and already found a roommate just like that. And then he returned shortly later. So the fact that there was a pattern in his behavior to just leave, you know, it certainly doesn't point that it was involuntary. Not that we're ruling that out, but nothing really raises our eyebrows to indicate such. Anytime you deal with a person who's gone missing voluntarily, it's difficult because the person who is gone, they don't want to be located, you know, for whatever the reason might be. And there is nothing criminal with going missing. And if Doug is around and he's still alive today, which, God, that's what we're hoping, you know, we just want to bring resolve to the countless amount of family members and friends who loved and cared for him so that they can have some closure and get on with their lives. But we certainly want to pursue our investigation with the open mindedness that anything could have occurred. And so, you know, that's why X amount of years later, back in September, you know, we sent out and solicited the help from Foothill Search and Rescue to send out their cadaver dogs to try to locate any possible remains. At this time, we don't have any persons of interest. We encourage people to come forward and bring us information to help us follow up on these cases and bring resolve to the families, because those are the ones who are really suffering from these types of cases. You know, it's the families. We encourage people to use our Crime Stoppers at 864-23-CRIME. People can call in anonymously. You know, there's, as always, there's cash rewards with information, you know, leading to arrest in cases. But the good thing with avenues like Crime Stoppers is people can call in anonymously. And even with bits of information that people might feel is seemingly insignificant, that could be a massive piece to the puzzle for our investigators.
If you're a longtime listener of this show, you know that the stories we tell are often just as much about those left behind searching as they are about the missing person themselves. This case is a perfect example of that. Ducky and Amelia were both very young when Doug disappeared. They were raised in an abusive environment and told that Doug had left them. And maybe he did. We can't say for certain that he didn't. Ducky and Amelia were cut off from Doug's family, but have since reconnected and learned so much more about their father, and have now come to question if their mother had something to do with his disappearance. Or is Joellen a victim in all of this too? We simply don't have the answers to those questions. It's been 24 years since Doug Jones disappeared, and in that time, they've uncovered little evidence to point to what may have happened to him. We know that July 30th, 1997 seemed like a normal day for Doug. He was seen at various jobs and stores purchasing supplies. He was looking forward to his family trip the following day to Disney World, but according to his wife, he never returned home from work, and his truck was later found abandoned near a creek not far from his home. There was no sign that anyone was injured in his truck. Doug's wallet and pager were missing along with him. They found his emergency stash of $300 in the glove box, but the $1,500 in cash that he had gotten from the checks he cashed that day was missing too. There are many theories about what happened to Doug. Some believe that his wife Joellen was involved due to their tumultuous relationship and the fact that the truck was found so close to home. It also seems odd that Joellen continued on to Disney World with a friend in Doug's place less than 24 hours after he went missing. In 2020, investigators tracked down the friend who accompanied Joellen on that trip. She recalled that they fought the entire time and didn't remain friends after the trip was over. Others wonder if Doug could have been randomly targeted for the $1,500 in cash that he had on him. Could someone have noticed that he had a wad of cash? The police point to Doug's mental health and the fact that he had taken off for 3 days a few years prior. Could Doug have parked his truck down the embankment and walked off to take his own life? Or could Doug have simply walked away and never contacted anyone in all of this time, and never used a social security number again? Doug's family continues to wrestle with all of these questions, feeling torn every step of the way, but they're hoping that someone out there listening has a clue and that they'll decide to come forward. If you have any information regarding the disappearance of Doug Jones, please contact the Greenville County Sheriff's Office at 864-467-5300.
Since I was so young, I feel like so much of my life has been based upon this huge mystery that I have no answers for. I have nothing. I have theories. I have people's gut feelings. I have the few things that we know from his disappearance from the police department and from what my mother has told me and from what my family has told me. But other than that, it is such a burden to not know.
That brings us to the end of episode 299. I'd like to thank everyone who spoke with us for this story. If you have a missing loved one that you'd like to have featured on the show, there's a case submission form at thevanishedpodcast.com. If you'd like to join in on the discussion, there's a page and discussion group on Facebook. I'm on Twitter at thevanishedpod and also on Instagram. If you enjoy this show, subscribe now and leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening right now. Do you want to help support the show? There are a couple things that you can do. One way to help The Vanished is by supporting our sponsors. You can find links and promo codes in the episode notes. Another way to support the show is by contributing on Patreon, where you can get early and ad-free episodes. Be sure to tune in next week. We'll be covering a case from Indiana. Thanks for listening. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Vanished ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today.
It's all a lighthearted nightmare on our podcast, Morbid.
We're your hosts. I'm Alina Urquhart.
And I'm Ash Kelly.
And our show is part true crime, part spooky, and part comedy.
The stories we cover are well-researched.
He claimed and confessed to officially killing up to 28 people.
With a touch of humor.
I'd just like to go ahead and say that if there's no band called Malevolent Deity,
that is pretty great.
A dash of sarcasm and just garnished a bit with a little bit of cursing.
This motherfucker lied.
Like a liar.
Like a liar.
And if you're a weirdo like us and love to cozy up to a creepy tale of the paranormal,
or you love to hop in the Wayback Machine and dissect the details of some of history's most notorious crimes,
you should tune in to our podcast, Morbid. Follow Morbid on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to episodes early and ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.